This week on Making Contact.
When I could not leave off of my porch at night because the governor gave a dusk to dawn, shoot to kill curfew that only applied to blacks.
I don't know why I just don't like really going outside that much. Cause it reminds me of the storm, like all the debris. Just look around. It used to look like a leak.
It's been 2 years since Hurricanes Katrina and Rita hit the Gulf Coast. 2 years since the levees broke and changed the face of an entire city, state, and region. And despite hopeful signs of renewal, New Orleans and many parts of the Gulf Coast are still in disrepair. So how much has really changed? How much has stayed the same? We'll relive and reflect on 2 years of on-the-ground reporting. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. By the time Katrina made landfall, it wasn't the great monster Category 5 it had been in the Gulf. When it hit the Louisiana and Mississippi coasts, it was a Category 3. But it was the storm surge that changed everything. The water overpowered levees, and almost at once, lower Ninth Ward homes were knocked off their foundations and floated into the streets. The Big Easy had not dodged a bullet. 80% of Greater New Orleans was now underwater. It was the worst engineering failure in our nation's history. Costly in dollars, but more importantly, costly in lives.
The storm is potentially so destructive that authorities have ordered the entire city of New Orleans, of more than 1 million residents, to be evacuated.
We cannot stress enough the danger this hurricane poses to Gulf Coast communities.
We are encouraging all of our citizens to leave the city of New Orleans. This storm is enormous.
Those who could leave did.
The roads out of New Orleans are moving at a crawl as tens of thousands of people heed the call to evacuate.
But tens of thousands were left behind.
Residents unable to leave because of poor health, age, or financial problems are being moved to special emergency shelters.
This is, again, going to be perhaps a historic event, and unfortunately a potentially catastrophic event.
Then, a national nightmare.
Hurricane Katrina is estimated to have killed thousands of people, forced the evacuation of tens of thousands more, and caused...
And we will not allow bureaucracy to get in the way of saving lives.
Why aren't we ready? Why weren't we prepared for something like this, which after all has been foreseen by many experts for a long time?
The cries for help seemed to go unheard.
Help!
These people couldn't leave because they couldn't afford to leave. Superdome people went in that shelter because they couldn't afford to leave. And now we're dying?
We don't have no running water. We can't be by ourselves. We're hungry and everything.
We don't either.
I need reinforcements. I need troops, man. I need 500 buses, man. Don't tell me 40,000 people are coming here. They're not here. It's too doggone late. Now get off your asses and let's do something. And let's fix the biggest goddamn crisis in the history of this country.
The guy who runs this building I'm in, emergency management, he's responsible for everything. His mother was trapped in St. Bernard Nursing Home. And every day she called him and said, are you coming, son? Is somebody coming? And she said, yeah, mama, somebody's coming to get you. Somebody's coming to get you on Tuesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Wednesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday. And she drowned Friday night. She drowned Friday night. Nobody's coming to get him. The secretary has promised. Everybody's promised. They've had press conferences. I'm sick of the press conferences. For God's sakes, shut up and send us somebody.
The power of the storms and the failure of warning week levees left chaos, destruction, injury, and death in their wake. They also left gaping wounds in the public trust and scarred the faith of communities who were all but forgotten by the U.S. government. And what about the invisible damage, the fragile mental health of survivors, especially the young? With a lack of permanent mental health professionals in the region, who's nursing the residents back to health? Making Contact, Sarah Olson traveled to Mississippi's Gulf Coast to speak with mental health care providers about what they say is an impending crisis.
These are exam tables. We slide them out, and this is the doctor's exam room. And right across is where we do the prescriptions. Now,
that's Judy Jones.
She's a registered nurse and the medical coordinator for the disaster ministry at the Bethel Lutheran Church in Biloxi, Mississippi. When she unlocks the door to what used to be the church library, she walks into a room that's packed, floor to ceiling, with prescription drugs.
The first section is all cardiac meds. The second one is blood pressure, psychiatric meds, and then antibiotics. So it comes all around the room.
The clinic has mental health practitioners on hand most days. But Jones says mental health is impacted by a lot of things not typically considered. Inaccessible health care, economic instability, lack of housing, child care, and job security, all these things impact the mental well-being of Gulf Coast residents.
No, I'm serious. And the patients are serious when they come, I'll tell you.
This is Peter Salome.
Hi,
he's
Peter.
From Virginia. He's been here. How long have you been here now?
I don't know.
I mean,
year and a half.
Year and a half. He's going to...
Some volunteers find they can't stay away, particularly when they witness the desperate state of the region and realize real change is nowhere in sight. And once you visit the region, that fact is perfectly clear. The Mississippi Gulf Coast remains in large part the way Katrina left it in August 2005, virtually destroyed.
You know, some people think we've recovered. And of course, we have not recovered. This is going to be a good 10 years before we do recover, and our infrastructure is missing.
Dr. Carol Jones is head of psychology at William Carey University's Gulfport campus. To find her, look for the second double wide in the westernmost row of FEMA trailers on the school's soccer field.
Housing and mental health, to me, seem to be the two biggest issues. And even when people get permanent housing, they realize that things aren't any different. We still have an environment that's destroyed. And this was a gorgeous place.
Dr. Jones is also director of Project Relief, a group providing crisis counseling in southern Mississippi. But it's as a Gulfport resident that Jones most understands the void caused by the destruction. She says even today, she'll occasionally find herself driving around town lost, familiar landmarks washed out to sea, the region's history gone with the tides.
And there were gorgeous old homes here built in the early 1700s that lined a 29-mile stretch of white sand beach. On one side was the beach, and on the other were these old antebellum homes. They're just so much rich culture and so much rich history that, yeah, it's hard. It's painful for me.
Dr. Jones says many trauma survivors begin experiencing symptoms after about a year, making a second wave of mental health needs easy to predict and prepare for. Unfortunately, the Gulf Coast has a frightening shortage of licensed therapists. So 15 months after Hurricane Katrina, when over 50% of those getting counseling at Project Recovery were first-time visitors, the region still didn't have the resources to deal with the crisis. And as hard as it may be for adults to understand this experience, Dr. Jones says it's even harder for children.
Primarily, the kids are saying, how come this hasn't gotten any better?
But after Katrina, there were some unusual obstacles. Washed-out roads, damaged cars, destroyed hospitals. The Mississippi Gulf Coast Children's Health Project responded by deploying mobile clinics. More recently, they acquired a first-in-the-nation mobile mental health clinic. Marjorie Gerhard is one of the social workers with the mental health unit. She says the stress on families today, 2 years later, remains off the charts.
As a result, you know, these behavioral problems that we're talking about so often are just symptoms of trauma, not having dealt with the hurricane or living in a FEMA trailer and just the stress that comes along with that. You know, we have many families that you're having three people live in a bed because the bunk beds for the children are filled with their clothes and their whatever they could have salvaged from the hurricane. So developmental stages are kind of disrupted in children's lives because, you know, they might have had a bedroom before, but now they don't, and they're sleeping in their bed with their parent.
Despite the stigma historically associated with mental health services, many people are beginning to ask for them. The irony of not having enough mental health professionals to go around is not lost on Marjorie Gerhart.
I think it's important for people to remember that this isn't something that's going to fix itself overnight. We see not enough mental health services here right now, not enough money coming in to support that. There doesn't seem to be a real value on it. So how do we change the discussion so that it's okay for people to seek these services?
For Making Contact, I'm Sarah Olson, Biloxi, Mississippi.
The government's response to the catastrophe failed in countless ways, and at every level. Shelters weren't properly suited to accept the tens of thousands of people who sought safety. Nursing homes and hospitals weren't evacuated, as they should have been. People were abandoned, and help was not on the way. 15-year-old Angelica Robinson and her family stayed in their home for 7 long days after the hurricane, waiting for help. She takes us back to those moments and explains how the experience changed them all.
My name is Angelica Robinson, and this is a story about my family. I have 4 younger brothers.
My name is Robert Robinson Jr.
My name is Christopher Robinson.
My name is Raymond Robinson.
And my mom was pregnant with my youngest brother, Elijah, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. 11, 12,
13,
14, 15, 16. All right. No, erase that. Then circle out how many sixes since you want to do it like that.
After Katrina, we stayed in our house for 7 days. Each day felt like a week. We all lost weight and started to look sickly. I lost 10 pounds, and the back of my hair started falling out in clumps. My brother Raymond got little red dots all over his face. My pregnant mom worried that she might lose Elijah. Chris's hair got so long that he had an afro for the first time in his life. It was hot. The water surrounding our home smelled like rotten cabbage, and my brothers and I thought we were going to die. On the 6th day, we celebrated my brother Robert's birthday.
I had a big pile of cookies for my birthday. My brothers made paper little toys for me. And after we sing happy birthday, I wished that the water went down. And I looked out the window, and then there was grass sticking out the water. I said, "Whoa, look at grass." And everybody ran to the door and looked. It looked like my wish coming true.
We didn't think that the storm would be as bad as it was, and that's why we stayed. It was a terrible week, but what alternatives did we have? My dad says that we didn't have any.
No way in the world I would have brought my family to the Superdome, where we are home, we are safe, and then we use resources inside the house for our survival.
After a week of sitting around the house thinking that we might die, my family evacuated to Memphis for 6 weeks. In some ways, it worked out for the best. My parents cleaned the walls and the floors of our home as soon as the water emptied out of it. That saved us from the mold that consumed almost every other house in our neighborhood. When we returned to New Orleans, we didn't have any neighbors. But for better and for worse, staying that week changed us. My mom, Angelique, feels mixed about the whole thing.
Well, sometime I like to talk about how strong you are as children. And then sometimes it makes me sad or depressed when I think about the negative experience we experienced.
My brother Robert has changed a whole lot. I remember the day when my dad took the training wheels off Robert's bike. He was 6 years old then, and he used to ride his bike until my mama called him in for dinner. He was obsessed.
But I just stopped riding my bike because I don't know why I just don't like really going outside that much. Because it reminds me of the storm, like all the debris. Just look around. It used to look like a leak. And it was quiet. But most of the time, I just lay around the house.
It may seem strange, but in some ways, our life is better than it was before the storm. The storm has made us stronger, both mentally and physically. I am more confident in myself. In school, people's harsh words used to hurt me to the core. But now they don't mean anything. My brothers have been drawn towards the physical side of strength. They began fighting a lot, and now they act like they could take on the whole world.
Like I'm a bad and hard soldier, I got very, very brave. I used to be very scared of crickets. One night, one got on me. I was about to scream at the top of my lungs, but I just looked at it. Like, it's gonna be alright, the cricket can't do you nothing, it's not gonna bite you. And it just flew off. I said, wait, that's just a harmless little bug.
My grandmama once told me, life has to hurt you before it blesses you. We as a family have experienced that firsthand. We have taken some serious twists and turns and have gotten lost on our journey to blessings. The water has been gone for a while now, and my family is still here.
Angelica Robinson reports for Youth Radio. Coming up next.
What is the problem with the federal government cutting the check? We're spending all this money in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but we're spending all of that money over there, and the money that could help these people get back on their feet is minuscule by comparison.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. A new issue facing New Orleans is a growing immigrant and migrant population. It's 6:30 in the morning. With a coffee in hand, Israel Lopez is standing at the corner near a Lowe's parking lot. It's cold out, but he's wearing only a thin windbreaker. He says he can't afford a new jacket right now because the money he earns he sends back to Veracruz, Mexico. That's where he's from, and that's where his parents live. But he also tells me he doesn't always get paid, and it's not for a lack of work.
Una vez que hicimos una casa entera, no nos la pagaron. En un día no la hicimos, no nos pagaron nada.
One time we built the whole house, and they didn't pay us. One day it took us, and they didn't pay us anything.
Israel arrived in New Orleans a month after the disaster. He specializes in construction. That particular job cost him and another worker $1,500 in time and pay.
He said he was going to pay, but he said we had to do another job in addition to the first job. We had to do some more work besides what we did so that it pays. But that wasn't the deal.
Israel is not alone. Dozens of men on this corner today have similar stories to tell. Stories of untreated injuries, unpaid labor, police harassment, and intimidation. That's where Marco Amador comes in. He's a field worker for the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice, one of a few but influential groups that sprung up after Katrina, helping the influx of immigrant and migrant laborers who arrived to rebuild the city. We met at a cafe in the Bywater.
I am part of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and we're a national organization that works throughout the country. The issues we deal with mainly are seeing how we can create spaces where day laborers can organize themselves to, you know, take control of their environment and their work areas and their education.
Marco is from Los Angeles. He came to New Orleans to set up a day labor program modeled off the program in LA. Because until recently, day labor organization and infrastructure was non-existent. Marco says the environment for immigrant workers was ripe for abuse.
And we just realized that there was a high level of police abuse, of police harassment, there was a high level of contractors stealing from people, and there was a really big health and safety issue that was just out of control.
Since Katrina, a very large Latino population has migrated to the New Orleans region. They've come from places like Guatemala, Mexico, Honduras, and Brazil. Some estimates say between 100,000 to 300,000 immigrants arrived in the Gulf region in the months following Katrina.
I do feel that the Latino community and the immigrant community has never been exposed and has never been put in a position like the one they are in here in New Orleans. I think a lot of things are being experimented here on how to deal with our population, how to deal with our community.
This phenomenon of a low-wage immigrant population is very new to New Orleans. The city has never seen large groups of Latino men standing on street corners waiting for work.
There is about 19 corners in the New Orleans area. So, you know, on any given day you have, you know, a couple thousand people out there looking for work.
Those 19 corners have now turned into more than 30. For many, this is not a welcome sight. I asked Marco to take me to one of the corners so I could find out firsthand what the workers were saying about their own experiences. We left the cafe and ended up at a Lowe's parking lot in Metairie, a city in Jefferson Parish, just outside the French Quarter.
Hola.
Hola,
me llamo Tina.
Marco introduced me and explained what we wanted to talk about. Many of these men are wary of the media and are worried that any discussion of who they are might lead to a reporting to INS or ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents. Having Marco involved, someone they know and trust, made all the difference.
Yo soy el señor José Castillo. Tengo más de un año de estar aquí, o años, dos meses de estar aquí. He luchado por ver a los hispanos que triunfen aquí. Ese es mi lema. Luchar, 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 luchar.
I am Mr. Jose Castillo. I've been here more than a year. I've fought so that the Hispanics come out on top here. That's my motto. Fight, 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 fight.
La policía, pues. Una parte me quejo de ellos, pero por otra no, por otra está bien. Porque tienen que cuidar aquí todo esto. Pero a veces también se portan.
The police, though, on one hand I have some complaints, but on the other, no, it's okay. Because they have to take care of everything here. But sometimes it's really, really ugly the way they behave.
En ocasiones yo perdí mi, me quitaron mi ID de México y me quitaron mi ID que yo traía de Florida. Eran los federales que decían que me dijeron que porque eso no me.
Once they took away my Mexican ID and they took away my ID that I brought from Florida. They were federal agents. They said it wasn't any good here. That here in this country it wasn't any good. So that's why they had to take it. Because here, that ID didn't mean anything.
Hay veces que se hayan buenos patrones y hay veces que se hayan malos patrones.
Here, sometimes you can find a good boss and sometimes you get a bad boss, you know? That's why around here, anytime you go out to work, that's the first thing you have to request, that they pay you when you finish your job. But there are some that won't pay you. There are some that leave you at the job site and they just leave like it's no big deal.
Pero sí es importante que nos organicemos en alguna manera aquí en esta esquina y en todas las.
That's why it's important that we get organized somehow here on this corner and on every street corner.
Gracias.
No,
gracias. Bueno, copas. Okay. Estamos viendo. Ándale pues, cuídese mucho, ¿eh? Ándale pues.
Musicians have always been the heart and soul of New Orleans. And like everyone else, they're struggling to survive, and only some of them have returned. And yet the bands play on. Correspondent Reese Ehrlich takes us on a drive through a nearly deserted section of New Orleans with a member of a local band called the Iguanas to learn how the rich historic music scene lives on.
My name is Joe Cabral. I'm one of the founding members of the Iguanas, along with Rod Hodges, and we're here in Rod's car, cruising near the lake. Go straight, Rod. We'll go up to Paris Avenue. They had 8 to 12 feet of water, and we kind of go up here a little bit. So I live half a block over here, and we had only 3 to 4 feet on our property. And this is my property here. That piano that's out in the front yard was my Steinway piano, and you know, yeah, completely. I mean, here's like, you know, some of my instruments. So there's some saxophones that were flooded out.
Joe Cabral and his fiancée lost virtually all the contents of their house, but they're relatively lucky because they still have a house. After a lot of renovation, they expect to move back in soon. But even in this upper middle class section of New Orleans, 2 years after the disaster, the neighborhood remains largely deserted because of the lack of infrastructure.
We didn't get power to our house until April of 06, right? Yeah, so it took us a while. We got phone service at the house in November of 06.
Joe's experience is repeated by musicians and others throughout the city. 64,000 Louisiana residents are still living in temporary trailers, and they're angry that the U.S. has failed to rebuild key areas of this historic city. Out at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, drummer Keith Frazier of the Rebirth Brass Band says his house was completely wrecked when a levee broke. He points out that Hurricane Katrina did relatively little damage to New Orleans. The disaster came when the federally built levees collapsed. The federal government has rebuilt the levees, but many residents don't believe they will withstand another major storm. Meanwhile, says Frazier, the city has about half the number of pre-Katrina residents, and the cost of living has shot way up.
A lot of musicians here in New Orleans stayed in New Orleans because it was affordable to live here. And now that rents are like four times what they used to be, I mean, you go from paying $300 a month to $1,200 a month, it kind of like pushes you out of the market. So,
state and city officials concede that many problems remain in southern Louisiana. But Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu says the state has also made a lot of progress. Tourism and culture now make up 14% of the state's economy.
What you're about to see today in a joyful, fun way is a huge economic engine that puts people back to work, and actually in the last 18 months has been the industry that has led the recovery of all of southern Louisiana. We have had now two successful Mardi Gras. You have now seen the Superdome and the Convention Center get renovated in record time, under budget, without a hint of corruption. Let me say that again. On time, under budget, without a hint of corruption.
Assurances from politicians do little to satisfy many residents, however. Trumpeter and New Orleans native Terrence Blanchard says Mardi Gras and music festivals bring much-needed money to the economy. But before Katrina, the city had other businesses, including a growing biomedical industry. Those other sources of income have almost disappeared. Blanchard says the private sector has a responsibility to do more than just promote tourism.
Some of the big corporations that want to donate money, they shouldn't donate money. They need to open up offices here. They need to create jobs here. They need to create some commerce instead of just writing a check. And little things like that can go an extremely long way to help rebuild in a city.
The federal government has allocated $110 billion for Gulf Coast relief, but most went for immediate costs, such as temporarily housing people in motels. Blanchard says not enough of that money has gotten to those who need it most.
What is the problem with the federal government cutting a check? We're spending all this money in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but we're spending all of that money over there, and the money that could help these people get back on their feet is minuscule by comparison.
Now, musicians and others dispersed around the country have hard decisions to make. Some have decided to stay outside Louisiana, having enrolled their children in school and found new jobs. Others are coming back to New Orleans. Iguana's co-founder Rod Hodges and his family now live in Austin.
We're sufficiently emotionally better that we can face coming back and dealing with all the stuff that you got to deal with. So I think we're going to come back. Yeah, we're going to come back in probably the summer, we're thinking.
For Making Contact, I'm Reese Ehrlich in New Orleans.
New Orleans and the Gulf Coast have come a long way since Katrina made landfall and the levees failed 2 years ago. And there's still a long way to go. Yet as the reconstruction and revival of the region grinds on, it's important to not just look back with regret, but to look forward with hope. So many are doing so much with so little, and they're making a difference. The resilient heart and spirit of the people is intact. Spend any time there, and you'll know. The region's greatest resource is the people, the culture they preserve, and the culture they create every day. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Support for this program comes from the Open Society Institute. Special thanks to all the people who contributed to this program, especially to Philip Babbage, Matt Fidler, Mike Lamar, Steve Maser, and Youth Radio. For a CD copy of program number 3507, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.